Good afternoon. This is Charlie Wilson sitting in.
We probably shouldn't say afternoon because we don't know when it's
going to
happen.
Right. Good day, everyone. This is Charlie Wilson sitting in for Ted, who is normally the person who does porch talk. And the reason why I'm sitting in for him is he is in the hot chair. He is the one who I'm going to talk about or interview today. So we can get a little background about another person, the key person, I think, at WWER, the station manager, is Ted Tate. And so welcome, Ted, to the microphone.
It's a place I'm used to, I guess.
That's right. Well, you're usually one of those like me that are behind the microphone. So now that you're taking the step forward into this, I would like to know, what got you started as a child interested in this, or were you?
Absolutely. I guess my first real exposure to actual radio would have been in high school, strangely enough. My high school had an actual licensed 10-watt FM educational station, which is a rarity, especially for a high school. Colleges tend to have it, but not high schools. So I was only about 15 years old when I was actually first on the air doing live radio. Although it wasn't my plan. My plan was always to stay behind the scenes. And I was a board op or engineer back then. That was what I had trained for when I joined the radio station, and that was what I was planning on doing. And then one day, one of the DJs didn't show up for his shift. You know how teenagers can be. Sometimes people just don't do what they're supposed to do. So that afternoon, it was a jazz show. We used to do jazz in the afternoons on WKWZ.
What city was that?
So this is Syosset on Long Island, New York. So suburbs of New York City. And so the DJ didn't show up. And I said, what do I do? And they said, well, you got to go do the show. So I just opened up the mic and thankfully did not have time to think about it, did not have time to get nervous about it because I was just thrown on the air with no notice. And so I just did it. And that was great, actually. Probably much better than if I had actually tried to do it, because I would have had weeks of training to get nervous about it and worry about my first time on the air. Instead, I just did it. And after that, well, I was already riding the horse, wasn't I? So I didn't need to learn.
Well, so did you end up taking that show over?
So I did. Well, not that specific show, but I ended up getting an air shift regularly. And so, yeah, I was doing jazz for quite a while. I also did some, we had some rock shifts and I did some of those. I still continued to do engineering stuff and, in fact, became chief engineer of that station in my senior year. And also produced and hosted a comedy show, a weekly comedy show on Saturday nights called Comedy Corner. And did that, and also occasionally guest hosted our trivia show. We had one of those call-in trivia shows where the host would ask questions and people would call in with the answers. And basically, I mean, again, this is public radio, just like we're doing here at WWER, and there were no prizes. We just tallied up points, and everybody who called in, they were on a team. They would give their teams funny names, like the broken down buggies, or, you know, the Monty Pythons or something like that, the Spamalots or something, you know. And each team had a name, and you could have more than one member on a team, and they could each be at home listening to the radio and all call in on behalf of the team, trying to give the answers to these trivia questions. And then the first person who got the right answer got the team got the point. And at the end of the whole show, we did it for like 3 or 4 hours.
Wow.
And it was the most popular show on the station, actually. And by the end of the thing, all we did was tally up the points and announce the name of the team that won. And that was like the big deal
bragging
for them.
Bragging rights, I guess.
It was pure bragging rights.
That's great.
No prizes, no nothing. But it was a super popular show on this high school radio station.
So then after you graduated high school.
Graduated high school, moved on to college. Of course, there was a college radio station. I got involved in that. And in
same
the
same general area?
No, actually moved on to Pennsylvania. So I went to college in Scranton, Pennsylvania. where supposedly the office takes place. And mm-hmm. every time I mention Scranton, that's what somebody comes up with. And I go, I don't know. I don't watch The Office. That was because when I graduated high school, my folks retired. And my mom was from Altoona, Pennsylvania. And so they retired and moved back to her hometown because that's where they wanted to be, in the mountains. And so as part of that, I went to school in Pennsylvania as well, and spent my summers in the Altoona market and worked at a variety of different stations in the Altoona market, mostly, again, doing technical stuff. I worked for this little 500-watt AM station in a podunk town doing transmitter maintenance from midnight to 6 a.m. for free just so I could learn about transmitters. And worked at a couple of other stations. I called it interning, but I mean, it wasn't even that. It was just following the engineer around, handing him tools and doing whatever I could to learn about broadcasting. But also applying for jobs at various stations, and got an on-air gig at the top 40 station in town.
Wow.
And actually ended up doing the 7 p.m. to 1 a.m. shift 6 nights a week, playing the top 40 hits.
Slip queuing 45s and everything.
We were back
on carts.
It was on carts, which are basically cartridge tapes that you could pop in and hit start, and that would start right away. Mm-hmm. We did some stuff on vinyl, mm-hmm. and so you had to queue up a vinyl song and all that. But most of it was on carts because mm-hmm. it was top 40 radio, and you were playing the same things over and over and over again. I had, in a 6-hour shift, I had to play the top 10 songs 3 times. In a 6-hour shift, and then you moved on from there. The stuff that was lower in the Billboard chart, you mm-hmm. played a little bit less often, maybe twice in a shift or whatever. And I can remember, you know, you didn't always like the songs you were playing. I mean, I liked top 40 radio, but sometimes you didn't like a song. And boy, if you didn't like a song and you had to play it 3 times a shift, 6 days a week.
So I guess the term top 40 was really a misnomer. Many stations, even PGC here, was pretty much the same thing, 25 songs maybe, would get rotated.
Yeah, I mean, you're right about that. And then... you'd throw in an oldie every, you know, 20 minutes or so, you know.
They would call it the classic spot. So you would have 1 an hour to make it sound like it was not the same song.
I think we had 2.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there wasn't a lot of that. And that was a lot of fun. And I really enjoyed being on the air. But I knew that it's really hard to be a DJ and get decent money unless you can break into a big market. And that's really hard to do. Mm. So when I graduated college, I should backtrack. While I was still in college, I also did an internship, an actual internship, where I got college credit for the Federal Communications Commission.
Really? You worked for Charlie?
I did. Charlie, as they called it, yeah, or the candy company, as we sometimes called it.
What did you learn working for the SEC?
So I did an entire semester where I was not at school. I moved to Washington for a semester, and I worked in the AM branch of the FCC processing applications. They were technical applications. They called them Special Temporary Authority for Parameters at Variance. Mm. Which was
in English?
Yeah, exactly. AM stations could either broadcast in just a big circle, which mm-hmm. is non-directional, or they could have a directional pattern where they could broadcast more power in one direction and less power in another. And a station typically had to do that if they had to protect other stations from interference, because one of the things that the primary goals of the FCC is to make sure that the airwaves aren't so cluttered that the stations are stepping on top of each other. And your license is what allows you to have unfettered reception for your listeners in a given community, a given town, like Colonial Beach has WWER, which is licensed to Colonial Beach and gets to broadcast with the guarantee that nobody else is allowed to interfere with their signal in the confines of Colonial Beach. So these AM stations had patterns that they were using to either protect somebody else or cover their city of license or whatever it was. To create that pattern, you had to do all sorts of RF magical wizardry, electronic wizardry, and have
the phaser.
The phaser, yes. The device called the phaser that you sent more signal to one tower and less power to another tower, and you'd have maybe two towers or three towers. Some stations had as many as five, I think.
WHMC in Gaithersburg had five in a row and one off to its side.
Yeah.
It was the weirdest pattern.
Yeah.
Because it was protecting somebody, I think, 100 miles away.
Yeah. So these stations, whenever something changed in their equipment or in, honestly, the local terrain, like a new building went up or something like that, it would affect their signal. And they would have to remeasure everything and make sure that they were actually transmitting the way they were supposed to. But while they knew that something had changed but hadn't had the chance to actually implement changes to fix their pattern, they operated with special temporary authority for operating at parameters at variance. nonsense. But basically it was a station saying, something's changed. We've tweaked our signal to make sure that we're still not interfering with anybody, and we'll file you more paperwork later to show that we're actually doing what we're supposed to do. And so they had a backlog of these applications in their system, and I went through all sorts of mathematical calculations to kind of prove that they were doing what they were supposed to do, and then send them a telegram back in the day.
A telegram.
The FCC communicated by telegram to the station saying, yes, you're good. You now have authority to transmit in this way. Please file your permanent paperwork as soon as possible, or whatever it was. And well, I did that for a semester.
You know, the guy that actually invented phasing arrays died just about 2 or 3 weeks ago.
No.
Yeah, he had figured this out because there was a problem with a power interference between one station, I think, in Chicago, the other in Detroit, and they wanted to be able to have both of these stations on, and this is in the early days, and he figured out this multiple pattern, multiple tower system, and from there on, it became very popular.
And where was he from? Do you know?
I'll have to look it up. It was in the Broadcast Engineering magazine just a couple weeks ago.
That he recently died. Huh. So anyway, I spent my time at the FCC not only doing that paperwork, but basically absorbing as much as I could about the FCC rules and regulations, and visiting other departments of the organization, and just kind of soaking it up because I loved radio and I was very interested in it. But I also, while I was here in Washington, I ended up falling in love with Washington and the area. So I decided when I graduated that this was where I wanted to work. Hmm. So from as soon as I was in my last year, I started applying to every radio station in the Baltimore and D.C. market looking for a technical job. Again, figuring that I couldn't get an on-air job because you just didn't do that. You didn't go from a no-market station to having, you know,
number nine market
going on air. Mm-hmm. But I kind of thought, you know, with my FCC on my resume, that maybe a station might pick me up as an engineer, as somebody who has some technical skills. And sure enough, that's exactly what happened. I applied to every station I could think of. I got two responses, one of which ended up being the full-time job that I got at DC 101, WWDC. And one of the first things that the general manager said to me when I started was, "So you worked at the FCC, you got some contacts over there, you're going to help us out?" That was his big thing. He wanted to. He thought I would have some connections over there that I could use.
and this is when they were both in the AM and FM were both next to each other in that old house, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the studios were actually not far from where we are right now.
Connecticut Avenue.
Connecticut Avenue and M Street, the corner. And I'm trying to think what the address was, but suddenly it's left me. But anyway, it's the corner of Connecticut and M. The company at the time was owned by the Bender brothers, and the Bender brothers owned the building. And so DC 101 and WWDC were on the second floor of that building, and had their studios there and the transmitters up in Silver Spring. And I worked for them for 7 years, doing what they called board op, which was basically turning on the knobs to for various broadcasts. I did mostly sports stuff. Mm-hmm. We had
with Johnny Holiday.
No. I was after him. Mm-hmm. I was after him, and I was after Howard Stern. Mm-hmm. Howard Stern had left DC 101 then. When I joined, they had Greaseman on the air, and we were doing a lot of sports. We were doing Georgetown basketball. We were doing Notre Dame football. We were doing all. We picked up Bullets basketball. We were doing all kinds of stuff. So I was board hopping for sports, and when I wasn't doing that, I was doing maintenance and repair on equipment. And I stuck around with them for 7 years, which is kind of unusual for your first job out of college. Mm-hmm. But I was learning a lot. The guy I worked for was kind of a pain in the butt. He gave me a really hard time for all of those 7 years, but he taught me a lot. Mm-hmm. He knew his stuff, and he was willing to teach. And so that made it worthwhile. And it kept interesting because one of the things we did while I was there was we actually moved the studios from downtown D.C. to Silver Spring. And there's no experience like building a studio from scratch, you know, and building a station from the ground up. So
why did they move?
Because the real estate in D.C. had gotten so valuable that the guys who owned the building at Connecticut and M wanted to rent out the space we were in instead of giving it to us for free. So they also owned a construction company, and so they built us new studios on the land that we already owned, since that's where the tower was, and built us a brand new studio facility, and then rented out the space at Connecticut and M so that they could earn more money off of it. And maybe it was a precursor, too, because eventually they sold off the station. Stations were being bought up left and right back in those days. It was a big deal. Stations were being bought up by conglomerates who saw it was a bubble. It was like the tech bubble. Stations were growing in value. I think the values got incredibly inflated, and so a lot of people who were smart at the time, quite frankly, saw the value and said, "Well, I'm going to sell this thing and cash out." And I think that's probably what they did at the time. And so eventually, some years later, the station did get bought out. And so again, the real estate guys could continue with their real estate and just cash out on the radio station. But by that time, I had left. I had started doing some part-time work for one of the networks, a network that probably nobody will have ever heard of because it doesn't exist anymore, called the Unistar Radio Network. Does that ring a bell for you at all? You're somebody who's been in radio.
No.
So Unistar was a network, and they had shows. They had a top 40 countdown show, kind of like many of them did.
Was this a satellite-delivered network?
Yep.
Out of Dallas?
No. Out of Crystal City.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, that's where our office was. Nearby. Mm-hmm. So they had a news department. They did news at the top of the hour for hundreds of stations across the country. And I worked for their news department as an engineer, basically keeping their studios running and keeping their equipment running. And they had a team of journalists who, you know, reported on the news and did these top of the hour newscasts, as you heard on every station in markets all over the country. But Unistar, the reason it doesn't exist anymore is because it did get bought out by what is now NBC Mutual.
Hmm.
And NBC Mutual already had a news department.
Therefore,
when we got bought, the first thing they said to us is, yeah, we already have a news department, so you guys, you're all gone, every last one of us. And I'd only been there a year.
Hmm.
So thankfully, they were nice about it. They said, take all the time you want. You can all use the fax machine and the phones to job hunt while you're here and keep working as long as you can. Thankfully, as an engineer, even after we stopped broadcasting from there, they wanted somebody to stay and turn off the lights. So I managed to stay almost to the end when they emptied the building because they still had some broadcasts going through the wiring in the building, even though we weren't actually doing any broadcasts from there. So they had an automation system there that had to be maintained, and they had some other things. So I was one of the last people to leave, which was good for me just because it allowed me more time to job search. And I was doing the job search, and it was kind of a funny thing. I was asked by one of my colleagues, do you have a resume?
Just out of the blue.
Well, we were all job searching.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
So, and he said, do you have a resume you can give me? I may have somebody who's interested in you. I said, sure, of course. Here's 10 copies, you know. And I never heard anything about it for some time. And then one day out of the blue, I get a call from a guy named John Marnie, who was the bureau chief for BBC News here in Washington. And he said, I was given your resume by one of your colleagues who does some freelance work for us, keeping our computers running. And we're looking for somebody who can run a soundboard and repair equipment as an engineer. Would you be interested in coming in to talk to us? Of course, I said yes.
Bingo, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the BBC is certainly a well-known name, and I was looking for a job, so I said, absolutely. And I went in for an interview with the guy. And I'll never forget, it was kind of funny. You know, they were just starting a new live radio channel called Radio 5 Live.
Mm-hmm.
And their big thing was doing live events, live sports, live news, all sorts of live shows. And they wanted to do some from Washington, so they wanted somebody who could run the sound desk for things coming from Washington. And they also wanted, in my off time, an engineer, a technician, much as I'd been doing in many other places up till now. But I remember John Marnie sitting me down and saying, but you don't have to take things apart. You don't have to repair equipment. You can send them out to be repaired. We just want you to kind of keep things running. And I laughed and I said, but that's what I do. I like taking things apart. I like fixing things. So he seemed nervous that I was going to be overwhelmed by the idea of actually having to take a screwdriver and take something apart and solder something and whatever. But I liked doing those things. And so I had no problem with that. So I started with I remember I left that interview thinking I did all right. And that afternoon, they couriered a letter to me offering me the job.
Wow.
Yeah.
Never heard of that.
Neither had I. In the meantime, I had also been applying to NPR. And NPR, as wonderful in an organization that it is, they don't move fast. And I had several interviews with them. I was told verbally that I had the job, but I was also told verbally, it's not guaranteed until you get the letter from us. And that may take some time because we're a bureaucratic organization and we have to get through HR and we have to do this and we have to do that. And it had been over a month that I had been waiting for NPR to answer me when this whole BBC thing happened. And then they courier a letter to me that day and I'm like, okay, this is good. And it was more money. And I thought, well, I've got to take it. But I called up the engineer that I was working with at NPR who had interviewed me, and I said, look, I've got a bird in the hand here. I've got a job offer. I know we've been talking. I know you've told me I can have the job, but unless you can absolutely guarantee me that this is actually happening, I got to be honest with you. I got to take what I'm getting, what I'm being offered. He said, I can't blame you. You go right ahead. Go with my blessing.
My son. Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. So that's what I did, of course. I accepted the job and gave Unistar my notice, which didn't require much at the time. But I did work a little extra time just helping turn off the lights. And started with the BBC, which at the time had a fairly small bureau here in Washington. We were only doing radio. We weren't really doing much television, little television editing, but no real live television or anything like that. And I was hired purely for radio. So radio and television actually were separated back then. We were in different floors of the building. And that was 25 years ago.
You don't look that old.
Yeah.
25 years.
Wow. Yeah. And of course, it's grown.
What have you seen change here?
Oh, my goodness. The technology has changed. Everything has changed. I remember when I started, they gave us cell phones, and they were those big, heavy brick cell phones. And it was, you know, kind of a cool thing to be carrying around, and you like picked one up and you put it to your ear just to look special, you know, because not everybody had one. But I tell you what, stuffing it in your back pocket was kind of difficult. And I remember trying to think, when we tried to do radio from the field, I remember being sent out on a lot of stories. So back in those days, even radio was complicated to do from the field. We had started doing some satellite stuff, and you could do radio via satellite, but I had to travel with 9 pieces of equipment in order to get radio on the air from something. And I remember one of the first times it happened, I was actually on vacation, and I had a pager, not a cell phone. They hadn't issued me a cell phone yet. And I was on vacation, happened to be downtown, sightseeing actually, just playing Washington tourist as you do every once in a while. My pager went off, and they said, there was a bombing in Oklahoma City. Can you go down there and do radio? So I went, sure. So later, I think it was that afternoon, I was on a plane to Oklahoma City and spent the next 2 weeks doing live radio from a parking lot, from a minivan with a bunch of satellite gear that I'd cobbled together and some radio equipment and that sort of thing. And I had I put a satellite dish on the roof of a minivan, and I built a little studio inside the minivan, and we did live radio for like 2 weeks.
Wow.
And did a lot of stories like that. A lot of bad stories, of course. News is, you know, generally bad news, unfortunately.
You usually don't send you out to say, had a great day today. You
know? Yeah, yeah. So I saw that. I went to, do you remember Swiss Air 111 up in Nova Scotia that went down? I went up there for that. Gosh, there were so many things. It's hard to remember.
And so at this time,
all.
TV and radio were still pretty much separate.
Very separate. Mm-hmm. Very separate. We had TV correspondents who only did TV, and we had radio correspondents who did radio, and producers and whatnot. And I was strictly a radio engineer. Mm-hmm. Obviously, I helped out the TV people with this and that when they needed it. But honestly, that wasn't my job. But it started to come together. We actually moved and combined the two. We moved the Bureau into a larger facility on a different floor of the same building, and that's when we combined radio and television, so they were all together. And we started multitasking, multi-skilling the producers and the correspondents. So now if you did a story, you did radio and television for that story, and the producers had to do both, and I had to start learning both. I had to start dealing with TV
stuff.
Yeah,
so I was wondering, how did you break into TV?
That's it.
Yeah.
That's it. It was just sort of a natural progression that I was the only technical person in the Bureau, and so I had to learn television when it went wrong. And a lot of other things. I had to learn about phone systems and computer systems and all of that, because it all sort of fell into my job description. I often get asked by people, so what does chief engineer mean? What exactly are you responsible for? And my answer is anything with wires in it.
And now all the wires are internet.
Yeah. Yeah.
Everything has changed. It's all IP based.
It's all a computer.
Yeah.
Everything's a computer. I mean, your phone's a computer. Your telephone is even, you know, your TV is a computer now. We've got smart TVs and all that. So it's all, you're right, it's all computers. And so much of stuff just travels through the internet. Mm-hmm. You know, now when we want to do live radio, we do it via the internet. We don't use satellite dishes anymore very much. We do at times when we go someplace that doesn't have a Wi-Fi or a Starbucks with a Wi-Fi, we'll go out and do it on a satellite dish. But the funny thing is, that satellite dish we use now sends it as data. Mm-hmm. It's still basically an internet connection that we stream back to our facilities, either here in Washington or in the UK.
So let's get off of the job for a second. What do you do for fun? I understand you have a unique living condition.
Yeah, I spend a lot of time on my boat. One might even say live aboard.
Mm-hmm.
I've been boating for a long time, and Actually, the story goes that my mother was pregnant with me when they were shopping for a boat.
Really?
Yep.
So it's in your DNA.
It is in my DNA. So back on Long Island, where that high school radio station was, is where I was born and raised. And my folks bought a boat while mom was pregnant with me. And so from the time I was in a bassinet, I was carried aboard the boat and brought on weekends for outings in the Long Island Sound. My parents were members of the Sagamore Yacht Club, which still exists today. I Googled it not too long ago, and it does still exist. And they had that boat till I was about 8 or 9 years old, and they sold it. And I remember it was an old wooden boat, too. You know, lots of work involved in that. You know, you had to – every year we'd haul it out, and Dad would sand it, scrape the barnacles off because it was salt water. And I remember they sold it. And I said, I'm 8 years old. I said, why are you selling it? And they said, because it's too much work. And I said, what work? I only knew the fun. Dad didn't make me sand it or scrape it. but I missed it. And so when I was in my mid-30s, I had an opportunity to buy a clunker of a boat, a 21-foot Bayliner, and with a crappy engine that conked out half the time. And I got it for cheap from a friend.
Did it float?
But it floated. it as I said, the engine crapped out now and then. I had a few. I got towed back to dock more than once. Or had to go real slow, but I still loved it. And so that was my in. You know, I got in cheap with a cheap, clunky boat and realized that that was something I really loved. And so I continued on with it and moved up in size from boat to boat to boat. So that was a 21-footer. Then I had a 26-footer. I had a 29-footer. Again, all Bayliners, actually. The three of them were Bayliners. And the last one I had for almost 10 years. Served me well. It was a good boat. A lot of people poo-poo the Bayliner brand, but I was perfectly happy with it. It served me well. And about 2 years ago, I finally decided to do one of my bucket list things and bought a boat to live on. And so it's a what they call a 45 med yacht. Made by a company called Marine Trader. This is a 1988 boat, so it's still kind of a vintage boat. Back in the 80s, you know, everybody was rich. You had everybody had money, and there was a big market for boats. And so Taiwan started churning out boats left and right. And the Marine Traders were made in Taiwan.
Wow.
I think their nickname is Leaky Tikis. They're fiberglass boats, but they have a lot of teak wood in them and a lot of glass. And when the seals around the glass leak, they leak onto the wood frames, and there you've got your leaky teak wood. So it's got a few little water stains here and there, but we love her. And live aboard when in D.C., and have a house in Colonial Beach, mostly weekends and vacations and things like that. But I discovered Colonial Beach by boating as well.
I was wondering what put you there.
Yeah. So Colonial Beach is a great boating town. It's about, three quarters of the way down the Potomac River. So if you're going from the D.C. area to the Chesapeake Bay, you pass by Colonial Beach. So on many of our journeys on those Bayliner boats, I would stop in Colonial Beach and met some wonderful friends down there and stayed in touch with them over the years, and every year would make Colonial Beach one of my stops in the boat on the vacations that I would take. And It was just, I don't know, the town had a charm to it. And I think most people who live in Colonial Beach can speak to it having just a certain charm to it that grabs them.
Well, and I noticed I was at your house just a couple of days ago, and It was built in when?
1937.
37.
Yeah.
So it has some history.
Yep.
It has some character.
Yeah.
Which is sometimes good and bad, you know?
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, so when there was a year, some 9 years ago, I guess it is now, that my husband and I were talking about, wouldn't it be nice to get a house down here? We were walking around Colonial Beach. Mm-hmm. We were on vacation, as we did every year, and just talked about how wouldn't it be cool to have a house down here. And suddenly we just decided, well, if we're ever going to do this, it was a time when prices were low, mortgage rates were low, everything was right. And I said, you know what? If we're ever going to do it, we need to do it now. This is the time. And so I guess it was about 9 years ago, 8 or 9 years ago, we did that. We went and bought and found our little cottage on the point that was built in 1937, wraparound porch. And that's where the idea for Porch Talk came from. We were sitting on the porch talking about the radio station and what kind of shows could we have on the air? What could we do, you know? And we would sit on the porch for hours talking about different things and talking with our neighbors who would drop by and say hi. That's one of our favorite things, is to just sit out on the porch and people just – we've had parties erupt out of nothing, you know, just by people dropping by. Mm-hmm. And before you know it, you've got, you know, maybe 10 people sitting on the porch just having drinks or iced tea or whatever and just talking.
That's great.
And so that was where the idea of, hey, we should do a radio show when we do the radio station. We should do a radio show called Porch Talk and just let people talk.
Well, it was great talking with you. And by the way, if any of you that are listening have any ideas for a show that you might be either interested in listening to or making yourself, give us a call here. Our email address is info@wwer.org, and we would be glad to hear from you, either that or just to say hi.
Great.
Thank you for being with me, Ted. This is Charlie sitting in for Ted because he was in the hot chair today.
Thanks, Charlie.
All right, bye-bye.